Hello, I'm Keith Perron, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. A schoolteacher in Guam is campaigning for the removal of the statute of limitations for civil claims related to child sexual abuse. George Washington High School teacher Joe Santos has launched a petition called Silent No More, which he plans to take to the Guam legislature to compel it to lift the 2-year time of limiting on filing a civil claim. He told Joe O'Brien he was prompted to take action after students came forward about sexual abuse.
I'm trying to get our senators, our legislators, to pass a bill and a law that will remove all civil statutes of limitations against individuals. So that will allow anyone that has become a victim, when they become old enough, mature enough, emotionally, and then financially, because it's going to cost money to hire a lawyer, that they would have that opportunity.
So do you think that's preventing many people from taking civil action?
The first thing that keeps them is that psychological barrier. It's somewhat embarrassing. That's the first thing that they have to overcome. Then they're confronted with the legal barriers. And that's why I say that there should not be a statute of limitations, because by the time they become emotionally mature enough, psychologically capable of confronting their perpetrators, their hands are tied. And then when they do become, at this point in time, the way the laws are written, by the time they are psychologically prepared and possibly financially capable, what's the reason for bringing it out? There's not going to be any justice. There's not going to be any closure. You're just going to reopen your wounds.
Do you know why this statute of limitations was put in place originally?
I really don't. I think these were some issues within the culture of Guam. Certain things are kept, how can I put it? It's your cross to bear. That's one of the statements that come out. And then again, there's this embarrassment to the family. So a lot of things used to get swept under the rug. But I think we're starting to become a culture that's able to face our shortcomings and bring these things to light.
Do you believe, from what you know, that there is widespread child sexual abuse in Guam?
For the size of our population, you know, we're, I believe, between 130,000 to 150,000 people. The answer is yes, that there is a huge sexual abuse, especially a child sexual abuse issue. I can't say why, but yes, at this point in time, there is a problem, and hopefully something like, you know, my petition, my movement, will be able to correct it.
The International Parliamentarians for West Papua has called for the international supervised vote on independence for West Papua. This group of politicians from around the world who support self-determination for West Papuans and are concerned on the ongoing human rights abuses against Papuans held a summit in London last week. Also present were members of the United Liberation Movement for West Papua, which was last year granted observer status at the Melanesian Spearhead Group. One of those in attendance was the Vanuatu government minister, Ralph Renganvanu, who spoke to Johnny Blades about the IPWP's strategy.
There is also a need for the whole process of the vote for self-determination to be revisited in light of the fact that the UN supervised vote back in the 60s when it happened was very, very questionable, basically a sham. So that needs to happen again, because the people of West Papua haven't been given the opportunity to decide on their future. And it's really a decolonization issue. It's not a succession issue or anything like that. It's a decolonization issue. And for that to go forward, we basically need the support of many, many more countries so that it can be addressed at the level of the UN General Assembly. One of the strategies that Vanuatu, for example, will be actively participating in and has been, as well as the other countries that were at the meeting, is to get more countries in support of seeking this UN-supervised or internationally supervised vote on self-determination again in West Papua.
In the wake of that meeting in London, the Indonesian House of Representatives has condemned it and called it a reflection of colonial acts. What do you say to that? Because they've also said it's a stunt trying to disrupt the unitary state of Indonesia.
Well, unfortunately, according to international law, that self-determination issue has never been addressed by a proper vote in West Papua, and that's been recognized at a number of levels, a number of forums. Decolonization never happened, and in fact, this colony was simply passed from one colonial power, being the Dutch, to another colonial power, which is Indonesia, which continues to colonize the territory to this day.
Now, that strategy, you know, you told me about in terms of through the MSG forum, we've seen divisions come up around this issue. Do you have faith in the MSG to be able to wrestle with this properly, to be able to get Indonesia to the table?
Well, the point is that we are going down all avenues to address this issue. Through the MSG, we're trying to bring Indonesia to the table to talk. The forum has asked for consultation regarding getting a proper human rights assessment done. We get the international parliamentarians calling for a supervised vote. So there are a number of efforts happening at different levels to try and address this issue in a range of ways. And so if Indonesia doesn't want to, you know, it hasn't actually responded to any of those. It hasn't responded to the forum. It hasn't responded to the MSG. Basically, we'll just take it to the next level. And ultimately, the UN is going to have to take it on.
Yeah, I mean, Indonesia is obviously sensitive to this pressure. It wants to engage with Pacific countries, but your government wants the Indonesians to be stripped of its associate member status at the MSG, right? How does that sort of stack up with being able to dialogue with them?
Well, you have said that Indonesia wants to engage with the Pacific, okay? Unfortunately, the call of the MSG for them to sit at the same table has been ignored. And in fact, they rebuffed the Prime Minister of the Solomons. There's been no response to the letter from the Prime Minister of Papua New Guinea as the chair of the forum to them, asking for some sort of human rights assessment to be done. The question is, do they really want to engage or not? Vanuatu will be happy for Indonesia to stay in as an associate member of the MSG if it comes to the table. But if it's not coming to the table, then why are they in the MSG? For Vanuatu, the reason that Indonesia is in the MSG is to talk about this issue with the United Liberation Movement for West Papua. If they don't want to talk about that issue, then why are they there?
And the United Liberation Movement is, depending on which Melanesian leader you speak to, some say they're just a technical group or a group outside of the region representing the interests of exiled West Papuans. I'm talking about comments coming from Suva, maybe sometimes Port Moresby, but in fact, we see the demonstrations in the last few weeks in Papua. There's huge support for the United Liberation Movement and for the MSG, right?
The United Liberation Movement for West Papua is recognised mostly within West Papua. It's only because the leaders within West Papua can't get out and get in these forums that we have people who are outside of the country actively engaging. People like the Secretary General, Okto Mote, people like the International Spokesman, Benny Wenda. I mean, these are all people who escaped as refugees in fear of their life. People inside Indonesia, they're getting arrested in massive amounts. They're getting killed. They're getting tortured. So they can't be at the forefront of anywhere the ULMWP goes to talk about this issue. But of course, they are part of it. They are intrinsic members of the movement and support it. So anyone who says that the ULMWP doesn't represent the movement in West Papua only has to see what's happening in country. Every time the ULMWP does anything, for example, the mass protests in support of full membership in the MSG, that's thousands and thousands of people in West Papua. The mass demonstrations in support of the International Parliamentarians of West Papua in London, thousands of people. The largest arrest, single arrest in the history of West Papua of West Papuans was because of that London meeting that we attended. So at that London meeting also, we had representatives who snuck out from the territory to be there. So I don't think there's any substance to the claims that the ULNWP doesn't represent the majority of the movement.
What do you and other people in the parliamentarians group make of the Indonesian government's efforts to foster economic development in Papua with more participation by the Melanesian population?
We received reports from, there were a few universities who presented assessments of what's happening. And while there is development efforts going ahead, there's a huge disparity on all indicators between the indigenous West Papuan population and the Javanese population who's been moved by transmigration to the territory. And in fact, what we heard from one of the international lawyers for West Papua, who's based at Oxford University, is that if you look at all those indicators and if you look at the historical development within the province, what's been happening, basically under international law, under the Genocide Convention, Indonesia is committing genocide.
A professor of meteorology at the University of Guam says drought conditions in Micronesia are easing, but normal levels of rainfall are unlikely to return until the end of the year. The region includes parts of Melanesia remain in the grip of a dry spell driven by a stronger than normal El Nino weather pattern. The professor, Mark Lander, told Ben Robinson El Nino has created a dramatic fall in the sea level around Guam.
The direct cause is the weakening of the trade winds that blow kind of at low latitude all across the entire Pacific. Normally the winds are from the east, from South America all the way westward to our side. And those easterly winds, in a very common sense kind of way, just push the water to the west, so it piles up on our side. The normal sea level, its natural state, it's about 2 feet higher here than it is, say, off the coast of South America. But when El Nino comes along, the trade winds weaken, and you get westerly winds. So the water slowly but surely drops in the west and rises in the east, so the whole setup of water can go in reverse. So with El Nino having a big change in trade winds, our sea level is dramatically affected. In fact, the difference between the very high stands of sea level when we're having La Nina versus the very low stands of sea level during El Nino is almost 2 feet. And that's the same as our tidal range. Our high tide to low tide here anyway is 2 feet. And it becomes very noticeable. At low tide, lots of reef is very exposed, and it's very dramatic. You can look out and say, wow, look at the tide. It's gone out, and the reef is high and dry.
So where's it at now?
It's recovered about 2 or 3 inches from its very, very low point in December 2015 and January 2016. So I expect it's just going to keep coming up for the next few months.
So with water effectively being pushed east across the Pacific, has that taken with it the rain?
Yeah, it does. The same El Nino effect, when those westerly winds come, the storms, the rainfall, all go further east than they normally are. But that's right now it's kind of at the last gasp of it. The rains are out near the dateline and further eastward. But as soon as the trade winds come back, all the rain will come back towards the western side, back to Indonesia, back to the Philippines. The Philippines are having a horrible drought, too. So our whole region in El Nino, the rains kind of leave here and go east. Everything goes east. Yeah.
So it sounds like the drought could soon be over. Can you predict that?
Yeah, we are. It's a normal dry season here anyway. But what El Nino does, or the post-peak of El Nino, it just makes it an extremely dry season, maybe half of normal rainfall or even less. And it prolongs the dry season, say from January to July instead of January to May. And then everybody starts to crawl back on average. They start getting more and more rain. Say even here on Guam, May and June, in a normal year, we start getting rain. We just had April, we only had about 1 to 2 inches. We should have had 4. May was supposed to have 5, we might get 3. June was supposed to get 6, we might get 4. And then by July, supposed to get 9, maybe we'll get 7. It starts by July or August. It inevitably crawls back up to near normal anyway. But here on Guam, it takes that long. Some of the islands to our south, Palau, Pohnpei, Chuuk, they come back a little earlier. They're already getting some rain now. Palau, finally, they had 9 inches of rain in April after having only 3, 4, 5 for many months. In fact, Palau had its driest year in 80 years of record-keeping from April 2015 to March 2016. But they just came back. They finally had a wet, relatively wet month. It was still below normal, but they had roughly nine inches of rain in April. So everybody's beginning to see a little bit more slow recovery for every jurisdiction, you know, all across Micronesia. We're all going to crawl back up closer and closer to normal. And then after July or August, we should be pretty much, we won't be excessively wet, but we'll come back to normal or slightly above by the end of the year.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. The warning has been sounded about fish stocks in Fiji after a newly revised damage at community fishing grounds in the path of Cyclone Wilson. The marine biologist Sangreta Mangabai stated an underwater survey of the coral reefs, which are a form of habitat of fish, which supplies people for food and earnings. She told Sally Round in the first few days of diving, she saw massive chunks of coral reef being broken off during the waves thrown out by Winston 2 months ago.
There's been a massive amount of dislodgement of very large corals, some of them up to 2 meters across, just broken off at their bases and really pushed up into the shallows. A lot of movement and breakage of the reef structure itself. You've lost a lot of habitat that's very important for the inshore fish in particular. So I think it's similar to what, you know, they've seen in other countries. Probably going to see a decline in the fisheries over the next couple of years until those habitats can really stabilize and also that recovery process can happen.
So how long does it actually take before fish stocks start to return?
Well, I mean, this is just predictions based on, I guess, you know, we know a little bit from some work in New Caledonia, some stuff on the Great Barrier Reef where they had a look at the impact of fisheries. And my colleagues on the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park Authority have sort of advised me that, you know, they saw declines in fisheries up to 2 years after a cyclone.
This is very worrying for those communities. They're pretty much subsistence level.
Yeah, a mixture of subsistence, but also there's also fishing for livelihood. So one of the reasons why we wanted to do this work is because the Department of Fisheries wanted a bit more guidance for these areas. I guess estimating how much fishing they could sustain after a cyclone, because obviously people need to feed themselves. You know, some areas previously had commercial licenses. You know, they want some feedback on whether those places can sustain those licenses. And then at the same time, a lot of communities are also interested in finding out they've had these tambu areas, these seasonal closures that they set up, sometimes, you know, up to 5 years, where they close an area off to build up the fish stocks. And so a lot of them are wanting to know whether, you know, they should be leaving them or they're in a time of emergency and that's what they're really set up for. Should they be opening them and try to harvest them to, you know, get a little bit of income so that they can use it to rebuild their lives? So these are quite big questions that we're going to have to try and answer in the next sort of 4 weeks at the sites that we do.
Do you have any idea at this stage as to what any of those answers might be? Should they actually go out and fish or are the fish there?
I mean, there is fish there, but I think it's going to be a combination. So what we're going to do is once we get across multiple different sites, we're going to get a sense of the scale of the damage on the inshore areas is the first thing. The second thing is very separately, the Wildlife Conservation Society, in partnership with a whole lot of NGOs in Fiji, have also done some surveys where they've actually gone around and questioned communities in which we try to find out for them what was their dependence on fisheries before the cyclone for food and for livelihoods and what is it now, so we can understand what was very important to them before. And then we want to match that up against the ecological data and the state of the reefs themselves. You know, I think it's going to be a combination. You know, we need to try and scale some of these things. Maybe there's some areas we might just say, look, the only thing that you should do is, you know, low-level subsistence fishing for the next few years. Other areas we might say, okay, it can handle a fair amount of it, or maybe it might limit the number of commercial licenses in an area. And then we're hoping there might be areas that haven't been damaged where we can sort of say, look, these are the areas where you could allow some level of, obviously within sustainable limits, of commercial fishing.
The autonomous government in Papua New Guinea region of Bougainville sees a return to mining as a key to developing its economy and the possible reopening of the huge Panangara mine, which is part of it. Rio Tinto, which owns 54% of the Bougainville Copper Limited, or BCL, has been criticized by the president, John Momes, of the Bougainville president, that is, for not saying what it is planning to do. But the chief executive of BCL, Peter Tower, says he regards of what Rio Tinto decides as BCL's vision to the return of Bougainville. He spoke to Don Wiseman.
With all large developments, there are lots of issues, and there's no exception. Obviously, community issues are of paramount importance, and given the history of the mining operation on Bougainville, it's very important the landowners are on side with the redevelopment, and we're talking about many groups of landowners, many families. So it's quite a complicated business to actually be confident that you have what in the mining parlance is called informed consent from all of the parties you need to. And then there are layers on top of that. We've got a Bougainville government which has expressed support for Bougainville Copper and for reopening the mine. But again, the caveat being provided the local community, the local landowners want the mine reopened and want it reopened by Bougainville Copper. And then above that, we've got the national government because, you know, at this stage, at least Bougainville's part of Papua New Guinea, and there's a big question about what will happen in the future. By 2020, Bougainville is required to have a referendum on whether it wants to stay part of Papua New Guinea or otherwise. So that needs to be resolved before, I think, any major development will take place on Bougainville, be it the Bougainville mine or any other major development.
Regardless of whether BCL goes back or not, as far as it would seem the vast majority of people on Bougainville go, there's a long-standing requirement that there is compensation, significant compensation for the, well, the effect of the mine back in the 70s and 80s on the province. Where does the company stand with that at this point?
Well, there are different aspects when it comes to compensation. Probably the most publicly debated claim for compensation relates to the period between when there was a compensation agreement in place and it just so happened that it technically expired about a year before the mine closed and it was due for renegotiation. Now, compensation wasn't paid for that period, so there has been an outstanding issue about that compensation, and a figure has been agreed between the parties, the landowners who are entitled to compensation in the company, but there are some other issues to be resolved about distribution and which particular individuals or families might be entitled to compensation, how it's going to be paid, what it's going to be for, and so on. So there's that angle, but there have been other claims about compensation more generally, and there has actually been litigation. There was litigation in the United States that went on for more than a decade over compensation, among other things. That particular piece of litigation was dismissed. There was another claim in Papua New Guinea itself in the national court, and although that hasn't been resolved yet, it will be resolved as part of the agreements in place now for the payment of compensation leading up to the closure of the mine. But I think more important than all of that is what are the benefits to the community should the mine reopen? You can call it compensation if you like, or some sort of benefits package. I mean, one of the main complaints landowners had when the mine was operating is that they didn't see themselves as getting a fair share of the revenue that was being earned by the mine. And it's a fair complaint, in my view, because something over 70% of all the profits from the mine stayed in PNG somewhere, but only a relatively small amount of that large percentage actually found its way back to or stayed in Bougainville. And that was one of the main complaints.
In terms of the change that was affected by the new mining law last year, if BCL agreed to reopen Panguna, you would have to renegotiate, wouldn't you, in terms of whether or not you actually can get a license to mine, because at this stage you have still only an exploring license, don't you?
Oh, that's right. But the reality is that irrespective of which laws are in place, and Bougainville Copper doesn't concede that one, either the national law or the Bougainville law, aren't inconsistent with one another and it needs to be resolved somehow. But irrespective of the legal position, the reality is that the company is going to have to negotiate an equitable arrangement with the landowners and the Bougainville government before the mine will reopen.
And finally, an aspiring Pacific Island hip-hop dancer has earned the opportunity of a lifetime to compete in the World Hip Hop Dance Championships in Las Vegas later this year. Duncan Matatolai, who hails from Solomon Islands, placed second place with the Brisbane crew Hood Nation in the Hip Hop International Qualifiers in Australia in April earlier this year. This secured them a place in the finals of the International Hip Hop Competition in August, where they will compete against some of the best hip-hop dancers in the world. Mr. Matalolo, who started dancing to Michael Jackson videos as a child, told Karoe Hawkins that he never in his wildest dreams ever think that he would make it this far.
It was really good. There was a lot of big crews and big names as well competing there, so it was a bit nerve-wracking. It was Academy of Brothers that competed as well. They've been to HHI in Las Vegas a couple of times already. Z-Boys Mafia. It's a mega crew of Z-Boys. Z-Boys used to be number two adults in 2014. So they're fairly big names. So now they have a mega crew, which is Z-Boys Mafia. And so, yeah, it was just an honor.
Right, and you managed to come place second in that qualifier, and that's earned you a place in the finals in Las Vegas this year.
Oh, yeah. So we ended up coming second in the qualifiers, in the Australian qualifiers, in mega crew division, after Academy of Brothers and Z-Boys Mafia coming third. So the top three from every country qualifies to compete in Las Vegas, which will be competing against all the other
Right, and this new opportunity, this going to Las Vegas, is this something that you are excited about?
Oh, yeah, I'm so excited, very much looking forward to it. Yes, I've already kind of sort of out everything with my calendar to just make sure I don't have anything on that period of time. It's just diseases and that. Coming from like a golden passport, another process.
Did you, when you started out dancing in the islands, did you ever think that you would end up competing in a dance crew in the finals of the Hip Hop International Finals?
I knew I always wanted to go there. I dream so much about dancing there. I guess every dancer dreams about that. Every dancer would like, why wouldn't you want to dance at the World Finals? I think the situation is kind of different for us back there because it was a third world country, and so you can dream, but it's not like you really think you're going to do it. So I think that was the situation there.
And now that you have achieved this, so to speak, or about to experience it, how do you feel now at this stage, and what would you say about your experiences to date?
I don't know, I'm lost in words. It's more of a humbling thing to me, I guess. I'm really happy, you know, like I feel it's so much happiness in my heart, but then again, it's really humbling coming from where I come from and just knowing that I know there's almost like another, I don't know, whole bunch of kids on the street that would dream to be like here doing that in my position. So I feel like I'm doing for my boys, like for my youths back in Florence as well.
What would you say to other youth, other young dancers in the islands starting out and maybe dreaming of achieving dreams?
I mean, I'll tell them straight what, like, you can dream so much as you can, like, nothing's wrong with dreaming, like, but the thing is that only you can make it happen, like, no one's going to get you there. Like, if you want to get there, your strength is yourself, like, you can get yourself there. Like, if you don't get up and do anything about it, nothing's going to happen. If you get up and do something, like, you can make it happen for yourself.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you'd like to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. You can also re-listen to this program at any time and past editions of the program by visiting our website. Just go to www.pcjmedia.com and click on the link for Focus Asia Pacific. A special thank you goes to Radio New Zealand International in Taipei, Taiwan. I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, saying so long, take care. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye.